The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, welcome. So what I want to do today is to read and then discuss a famous verse, passage from the Dhammapada, that is sometimes called something like the universal discipline. The word patimokkha is the word that's used for the discipline of the monastics. They have all these rules they have to follow, somewhere between 227 and 311 and more. They stop counting at some point, but there's many, many rules for monastics. It's part of their discipline. And this one sometimes is considered kind of the universal rules of discipline, not just applying for monastics, but for everyone. And it's relatively easy to memorize, so you might want to memorize it. So this is my translation. The first line is translated as most people do. In recent times, I did this 20 years ago, this translation of the Dhammapada. But I think, and I'll offer you my more recent. Doing no evil, engaging in what's skillful, and purifying one's mind. This is the teaching of the Buddhas. So it's very poignant, and it is ending with this. This is the teachings of the Buddha. Puts this up, elevates this as being a pretty important little passage. And maybe it's the kind of underlying principle that all Buddhist teachings can be kind of be an extension of and arise from. And so the word evil, I think, is a little bit problematic to use it to translate this word. The Pali word is papa, and whether it should be evil or not, I doubt it should be evil, because in English the word evil has such a huge Western Judeo-Christian association that I don't know if it's appropriate for Indian religions and for Buddhism. And so I now would like to translate it as doing nothing malevolent. Not doing nothing malevolent. And then engaging in what is skillful. The word skillful is kusala, which can also be translated as wholesome. And wholesome has more of a feeling of something, for me, of something that's nourishing, something that is healthy, health-producing. Whereas skillful has the connotations of that is just, you know, that is, has someone has is capable of doing something in a useful, in a beautiful way or skillful way. And it's a very important word, and the fact that this word can mean both wholesome and skillful speaks to something very profound about the training in Buddhism, how we're training ourselves to become skillful in what is wholesome. Some translators will simply translate this line as, let's say, do no evil, do what's good. Just, it's kind of very simple, easy to remember then. But doing nothing malevolent, engaging, cultivating, intending, you know, working at, doing what is nourishing or healthy or skillful or wholesome. And then purifying one's mind. So when I was thinking about this today, I was reminded of medical ethics. It's on my mind regularly enough because I'm on an ethics committee at a local hospital. So the basic ethical principles are quite important for the ethics committee and for hospital staff to consider. And it's a little bit similar in that depending on what order, different places have different orders of the basic principles, but is avoiding maleficence. I think I'm pronouncing it right. Maleficence. So doing harm, doing ill, and doing what is practicing beneficence. So doing what's beneficial. And then in hospitals, the other important one is respecting the autonomy of the patient, of the person under care. That everyone has the ability to make their own choices, if they do have the ability. Sometimes people don't have the ability, and that becomes a... That's one of the reasons why an ethics committee in a hospital is engaged, because if the person can't choose for themselves, should it be the doctor, should it be a wider committee, what's the ethics of it? And then it's respect for the patient, respect for the human rights, respect for their dignity, kind of a respect for patients. And sometimes what's added in hospitals is solidarity, that the medical staff should be in solidarity with the patient, kind of be their champion, be their companion, be their, you know, in their camp, kind of. So I kind of think that's pretty good for Buddhism too. That so this, you know, these first two are related for sure, and so it has this very strong statement at the beginning: do no evil, do nothing malevolent, and that's like a line. How do you know what's malevolent? How do you know what is, you know, some of it has to do with our intention. Is there ill will? Is there hatred? Is there hostility? And that's what's, for me, is behind malevolence. Making things worse, you can make things worse with good intentions. So I also like the idea, don't make it worse, because there's a little bit higher sensitivity than just simply, was my intention good? And that's sometimes not good enough. And so, but here it's kind of very clear, nothing malevolent. The second one, it doesn't say do good, like, you know, this is what you have to do. It says engage or cultivate, develop your capacity to do what is skillful and what is wholesome. And those are the things, by definition in Buddhism, that come from non-greed, non-hatred, and non-delusion. And then the positive terms of it would be, comes from the things that are opposite to greed, opposite of hate, and opposite of delusion. And some people like to make it really simple by saying, do what is generous, do what is kind or loving, and do what is wise. Last night, I'm still a little bit... What's the right word to say here, sitting here? I'm still a little, under the influence of the movie that I saw last night. It was kind of a movie that was kind of discombobulating in some ways. And as it discombobulated you, I think intentionally, more and more and more, it comes to the final conclusion, which is be kind. So it's this movie, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. So if you've seen it, if you want to be discombobulated, you can just take the message, be kind. Then you don't have to see the movie. So in medical ethics, one of the challenges is sometimes you don't want to cause harm, but you want to benefit, and sometimes those two principles are in opposition to each other. And so then there's a whole discussion about how to work that out. And I suppose that's also true in our ordinary human life as well, that it's not so often so clear, you know, or so always just one way or the other. It's like maybe a little bit of both. We do make it worse. I mean, some of us, you know, maybe the transportation, how we got here today, you know, it's probably made the world a worse place. But if we avoid any kind of making the world worse, would we then not even make it much better? And my hope is that I've dedicated my life to the idea that Buddhist practice and these Buddhist values will make the world a better place, make better people, people who are interested in benefiting the world, changing the world for the better. And so maybe we have to compromise a little bit. You know, we drive here, and in the bigger picture, maybe we find it inspires us, moves us, makes us more capable of living a life that's maybe with the challenges that come. So we become agents for good in this world, for benefit. So, you know, we're balancing all these things. But here, the Buddhist principle is not make it worse, which has beneficial to see that, but also has challenges to understand exactly what that is and how do you balance stuff. But here the principle is do nothing malevolent. And that's a kind of, I think, a wonderful line. Maybe hard to do, but that's the line we were trying to live on. On this side of malevolence, we're not going to go into doing something intentionally with hostility and harm. And we still might make things worse, but at least we know ourselves well enough that we are not doing anything malevolent, you know, intentionally. And, you know, most people don't think of themselves this way, and it might not be an inspiring teaching, you know, do nothing malevolent. But I think this world needs a dedication to this. And for those of us who are basically not malevolent, I think it's possible to up the game, be even more sensitive, more attuned. And I think this is one of the things, the benefit of Buddhist practice, is to become more and more attuned to the subtlety in which this works in our minds and our conversations and our connection to other people. And I mean, it could be something, I don't know if it's subtle exactly, but something so small is the way that you complain. You know, there might be complaints that are appropriate. You go to the complaints department because, you know, something didn't work. Complaints may be, you know, to say something, by the way, I want to let you know something didn't work and, you know, and maybe you should know about this. And they say, oh, thank you. We're grateful to know that. Versus coming and say, you know, you guys messed up. And, you know, then you're kind of like sticking it at them, you know, and then there's malevolence, there's some hostility, some, you know, or, you know, like if you're living with someone and I can't believe you left the dirty dishes in the sink again, and, you know, and, you know, it could, you know, you know, the tone of voice, the way it's said, you're kind of, you know, you're kind of like angry and a little bit hostile. And it's a complaint, right? But does a complaint have to be hostile? I have a notification to make about dishes in the sink. Would you like to hear it? It would be helpful for me if I could say something about the dishes in the sink. Is this the right time? And as opposed to growling or something. So I'm just trying to maybe say something very basic. But even this, you know, as we develop in this practice, we might not think of ourselves in terms of doing something malevolent or evil. It's a big bar, right? Maybe I hope it is. But to start becoming looking at it in more subtlety and more subtlety, and I think that's natural as people develop. In the mindfulness and the practice and the concentration and the stillness, that there's a more and more sensitivity to the impact our own states of mind have, the impact of our words, the impact of our intentions that we have. And one of the principles we'll discover is that if you do something malevolent, if you have to do anything with any hostility towards anybody else, you might be harming them, but you will definitely be harming yourself. And you can't harm anybody else intentionally with malevolence without harming yourself at the same time. And I've known people who've only given up their malevolence when they realize that. Ouch, you know, I had no idea how much I was harming myself. People who have harbored resentment or anger for years. And resentment is a kind of, I think, it's a kind of malevolence. Maybe other people use the word differently than I do, but I think of it in that way. And then I've known people who only after years realizing, oh, the person I'm resentful to probably doesn't even remember I exist. I'm not harming that person anyway. I'm not getting back at that person anyway. The only person who's hurting by my continued resentment is myself. And I know some people, that was the key that, oh, okay, they put it down. So this increased sensitivity to this mutuality of, you know, the harm goes both ways. And then this wonderful word, skillful or wholesome, kusala, it also has the same direction, that as we've been, as if we do something skillful, do something good, wholesome for the world, we're benefiting ourselves. If we're cultivating what's good, wholesome, ethical, skillful in ourselves, inevitably it'll be beneficial for the world. The world needs more examples of people who are living a skillful, wholesome, good life. Now, how do we do this? And how do we do it so that it's not just living by principle, like this is how I'm supposed to be doing? And that's the third principle here, purifying one's mind. And I don't know how it is for you to hear this term, purifying one's mind, as a principle. I know that for me, when I was younger, I was repelled by this word purification, purity. It had connotations of maybe of some kind of excessive puritanical notions, some idea of dualistic ideas that you're either completely pure or not, and it seemed like a standard that lended itself to a lot of judgmentalism of people, that if you're not pure, you're not good or something. Sin and purity kind of idea. But over the years, I've come to appreciate it more and more. And what I appreciate about it is that I now associate this word purity with something that becomes clean. Something that becomes clean. For the mind to become clean. And to view your own mind and see that it's clean, that it's kind of clear. There's no any negative word we use, will arouse some resistance for some people. But there's no dirt in there. There's nothing malevolent. There's no hostility. There's nothing greedy. There's nothing that we would feel somehow awkward about having in the mind if your mind got plugged into a monitor so that everyone can see what goes on in there. Oh, wow, that's what that person, that's what he, she, they think or are doing. So if your mind was public to everyone, it would be no problem because it's clean. I think that I came to appreciate this through doing this Buddhist practice, where at some point the most beautiful thing that I've ever seen in this world, I've seen many beautiful places and many beautiful things, but I think that the most beautiful thing a person can encounter and see or perceive is a clean mind. And to have touched that, which I feel like I've touched in myself, it's just astounding to see that this is a possibility for us. So, clean your mind. We clean our teeth, hopefully, every day. We clean our bodies most days, shower, whatever we do. And we clean our dishes. Why not our minds? And, you know, if you brush your teeth twice a day, maybe you should clean your mind twice a day, meditate twice a day. Why not? You know, mind isn't. Why not? Why do it is that the mind is probably one of the most influential forces in this universe of ours. One of the most influential, at least in the human world. It's like really, really influential. And the harm comes from it, the desire for benefit comes from it, love comes from it, hate comes from it. And so to clean the mind, and then or empty the mind. Another way of saying it is to empty the mind of greed, hatred, and delusion. Empty the mind of attachment. And then the amazing thing happens is that it just feels natural then to avoid malevolence. It's not like a moral injunction. You're just like, of course, why would I do something malevolent when that's doesn't just make the mind dirty again, it actually scars the mind. That's powerful language, isn't it? It scars the mind. That if the mind is overly scarred, one more scar you don't notice. You don't even know you're doing it. But when the mind becomes clean, you see the effect it has. And then engage in what's skillful and what's nourishing, what's wholesome. It's not an injunction. It's like, of course. That's what a clean mind wants to do. That's what it is about, is to do the things which are clean, to do the things which are healthy, that's nourishing, supportive. And so the last one, purifying the mind, I had a little bit of struggle with that for a while because my first Buddhist practice was in Mahayana Buddhism, the Buddhism of Zen Buddhism, where they had three kind of principles like this. The first two are basically the same: avoid evil, do everything that's good. But the third one was liberate all beings. So this idea of compassion. And I love that, the idea that we'd live for the liberation, for the benefit of others, and that was a dedication to practice for that purpose. And then the criticism of the Mahayana of our tradition is that we're the selfish ones. We're the ones who are just involved in our own practice for our own liberation. So then the contrast of this line, purify your mind versus liberate all beings, seems to accentuate this divide. And so I was a little bit troubled by this for a while, but I came eventually to realize that that these two things are not so separate. That if we clean our mind, purify our mind, empty our mind, it's then there is this greater sensitivity to harm and to other people and the state of other people, empathy, mirroring other people, understanding other people, caring for other people, that the natural outcome of a clean mind is in some appropriate way for each person that we do care, we do want to liberate, we do want other people to benefit. And it's a little bit like, you know, on the airplane where you're supposed to take the oxygen mask on for yourself first before doing the children or someone who needs help. It's a little bit like that, that, you know, before you help someone else not be malevolent, maybe you should do it yourself first. Because how well can you help other people to be non-malevolent if you're still being malevolent? How much can you help other people to do things which are skillful if you don't know what's skillful or what's wholesome, haven't cultivated for yourself? And so these all go together, and I don't think that any of these are so separate: self and other, benefiting oneself, benefiting others. They come together more and more as we practice in Buddhism, as a singular whole, and we're inseparable from each other. And that just seems so beautiful to me that that's the case. So these three principles that kind of simplify all the rest of Buddhism. And some of Buddhism is philosophically profound, which can mean sometimes that it's difficult to understand, complicated. But if you remember, it all arises from these simple principles. Everything's an expression of that, or a manifestation of that, or a commentary on that, or a support for that. You know, then maybe it's all kind of simple. So I'll read it again with my current translation choice. Doing nothing malevolent, engaging in what is skillful, wholesome, and purifying one's mind. This is the teaching of the Buddhas. So that's the talk. We have a few more minutes left in the time that we, for the scheduled Dharma talk time, and then after this we'll have a picnic outside for those of you who'd like to stay. But if you'd like to ask any questions or have any commentary about what I said, you're welcome to. And
thank you, Dr. Bronsall. I thought your commentary about the medical connection was pretty apt. I believe the Buddha Gautama was actually referred to as the physician. So I just found that connection.
Nice. Yeah, yeah. I'm inspired by the connection as well, or the overlap, and inspired by the medical ethics and just in general. I wish it, the rest of society would adopt it.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, you can pass that back, but we'll let Edna speak first.
It's Thank you very much for the talk, Gil. I have a question about, purifying the mind and cleaning one's mind. What about when the emotions are really strong and kind of rule? Then what would be the method of cleaning one's teeth, cleaning one's mind with strong emotion?
Yeah, I think that meditation practice is an optimal way of doing it for many people, because we're cultivating the mindfulness to recognize what's happening in the mind. And the recognition is very, very helpful, especially if the recognition of what's in the mind goes together with relaxing the mind, settling the mind, stabilizing the mind. Because then you're beginning to let go of the agitation of the difficult aspects of mind, the unclean aspects of the mind. And so to see it clearly and allow it to settle, and that more it settles, the more you see kind of a calm mind, a clear mind, a clean mind, then the more you have a new perspective to catch the difficulties that arise when they do arise. Because we have this background now of, like in a clean cloth, you see a little, spot of grease on it right away. But a cloth that's full of grease, you don't see one more spot. So we start seeing more and more. So I think meditation is a great way to do it.
Thank you.
And everything else Buddhism teaches.
I really appreciated the talk. I think there's so much, so simple, but so complicated as well in terms of how to apply. But I just wanted to make a comment, the idea about resentment. Good friend of mine had said resentment is like taking the pills and expecting the other person to die.
I've watched some videos on medical ethics in my teaching, and I remember one of the pillars, the four pillars, one of them is justice.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about justice as, that's sort of working things out in the bigger system, in the whole community, maybe more of a Sangha way of looking at things.
Yeah, yeah, justice, yeah. I know sometimes that has to do with equity and fairness, and the big part of it is the fair usage of limited medical resources. Who gets it, and how do you decide who gets it when it's limited, and how is it justice, how is it fair? And there's one back there. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
So I've grappled a little bit with the speed of response. So the dirty dishes analogy, for example, the one you gave, the amount of time it took to settle yourself and ask the question, you know, rather than the gruff, like, why are the dishes dirty again? You know, the calm, equipoise, non-malevolent way feels like the environment is our dirty dishes and our response is not speedy enough. So how do we approach that with non-malevolence, if you understand the question?
Well, maybe not, but let me try anyway. Is that I think that as we develop mindfulness, more ability to monitor ourselves as we do it, we might not have the capacity to notice the subtlety of the intentions, what we're doing in the mind. But ideally, we get enough ability to monitor what we say and what we do with our hands. And so to really bring a lot of attention to our tongue and our body. And then learn how to restrain. And then at least restrain any time you're going to say something that you have doubts whether this is really kind. And that restraint, which is not a very popular thing to do, might be the protection you need, so you have the time then to go look deeper. And that's why the principle of don't make it worse. So just learn to restrain, learn to hold back. And so if your hand goes into a fist, restrain.
and the follow-up there is that even the restraint feels like an injury to self. Like as I contemplate the climate change and what I should be doing.
Yeah.
If I'm not doing, then I'm somehow harming myself and not really all that beneficent actor.
Yeah, so we do the best we can, but don't make it worse. So if the best you can do is not make it worse in the environment, but you're still, harming yourself in some way. But you also want to kind of look more deeply at how you're harming yourself. You know, yes, if you're driving a car, you are indirectly harming yourself. Comes back to you a little bit. But if you're drowning in guilt, drowning in self-hostility, drowning in self-criticalism, then you've added maleficence towards yourself. Then there's malevolent feelings, attitudes towards oneself. And any malevolence is not needed. So then the training, the practice is to discover how not to view oneself or to add malevolence, hatred, hostility towards oneself. And that's, I think, is brilliant. How to live in this world without malevolence towards oneself or others, so we're not struggling with guilt. And in the Buddhist definition of guilt, it isn't just simply that we did something that's wrong and know it. Guilt is has this sense of self-hatred in it. And so the practice is to purify ourselves of that. That's as important as not having malevolence out there, harming out there. You don't want to pollute yourself.
This reminds me of that penultimate moment of the Buddha's enlightenment where he turns inwards and notices the second arrow.
Yes.
And pulls that out. And this is... But I've been stuck with that second arrow recently with some of these, the events of the globe.
Yeah, it's challenging to be a human being, especially in this modern world. And so part of the skill of practice is also to learn to somehow be a little bit more relaxed, or have the capacity to feel the discomfort that we feel, to feel the challenges of the mind, and not to add second, third, or fourth arrows, but to kind of somehow build the ability to open up kindly to how challenging this for us and what we're doing in our inside.
Thank
so
you.
One last one behind you. And is there, okay.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to sort of add one slight thought on the physician's oath, which also begins with first do no harm.
Yeah.
And it seems really interesting that there's not only that parallel, but the comment you made about the rules for the monastics. In some sense, the physician has an extra obligation as a decision maker, as someone who's in charge of the patient's life. And another way that they sometimes think about it is, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good, which goes back to your initial point of, you know, don't make it worse.
Yeah.
So that's something that I've sort of ruminated on as your Dharma talk sort of unfolded, and I thought,
great.
You know, sure.
Great. Thank you. Yeah, it's a wonderful principle, don't make it worse. I think it's fantastic to carry that with you and like, what? What? So, thank you. So we're going to take one question from the YouTube audience that someone put in the chat. So
Evelyn asks, Gil, how do you navigate the idea of putting one's mind on a screen where everyone can see how clean it is, with avoiding shame and embarrassment about all of the current blotches?
Yeah, that's a good question. How to avoid shame and embarrassment? Well, some degree of embarrassment seems healthy. You know, that does not necessarily self-harm, or not necessarily self-hatred or something. It's just like, oh, you know, this is unfortunate. And but shame maybe is much more painful and difficult. And to what degree shame has some kind of self-harming aspect to it that's unnecessary. It's a profound thing. There's a lot of people who feel shame, and it's a difficult state, and one that sometimes learn from society, learn from other people, and we internalize it for ourselves. So it might be that before making your mind public to everyone, maybe resolving the issue of shame, understanding a little bit I don't want to make it harder for anybody, the idea of shame, what I'm about to say. It's meant to be kind of freeing and compassionate. But shame involves a degree of conceit. And not the conceit of being arrogant, the conceit of being a little bit excessively preoccupied with ourselves, with self-identity and how we're represented, how we're seen, and how we're understood. And of course we are that way. Our society trains us to be that way. But Buddhist practice shows us how much we can let go of self-preoccupation, self-definition, a kind of attachment to self-ideas that we have, self-views about oneself. And then it's a lot easier to have our behavior transparent so other people can see it, because it doesn't get stuck in our self-concept for ourselves. We don't linger in it. We try to do better, but we don't define ourselves by it. So to really study this idea of shame and free ourselves from it before we become more transparent, I think it's really worthwhile. When I was ordained, as a Zen priest, Zen monk, 40 years ago. And one of the remarkable things that happened with that ordination that I wasn't thinking about or planning, it just kind of happened, and I saw in the weeks after the ordination, was that now I was a public figure. You know, I had a shaved head, I wore robes, and so I called it my shortcomings, were much more obvious, and I was much more conscious of them than I had before. And at the same time, it was more okay to have them. But it wasn't like I barreled ahead and just did terrible things in the world because I had these shortcomings. I was going to practice with them and try to work with them. And I had anger, so I had to kind of work with my anger and try to keep it in check so it didn't cause harm. But I became much more sensitive to these shortcomings. But it was more okay to have them because in the language I had back then, I was now a child of the Buddha. I had been ordained. And somehow, being a child of the Buddha, I was now in the fold of the Buddha's lap. You know, I was not being held by some compassionate, caring force in the universe somehow. And I was accepted for who I was as a practitioner with my shortcomings. So there was this wonderful, I thought it was really significant to both become more sensitive to my shortcomings so I could practice with them and work with them and clean. At the same time, it was in certain kind of way more okay to have them. And that made it a lot easier to work with them. Because I didn't have the conceit, the concern, I didn't feel the shame for having them. It's more like, of course I have them. Now I get to practice with them. So, Evelyn, I hope my answer is a very important question you asked, and I hope that my answer gives you something to chew on that's useful. So thank you all for this being here. And so maybe there's some announcements about the potluck and how that's going to work.